Good morning, everyone. In the matter of State versus Louise Maisonette, may we please have appearances of counsel?
Margaret McLean, Assistant Deputy Public Defender, on behalf of Mr. Maisonette.
Joe Johnson from the American Civil Liberties Union of New Jersey, as a friend of the court.
Assistant Prosecutor Nicole Campbell-Malone on behalf of the state.
Good morning, counsel, and welcome. Ms. McLean, please proceed. And I'd ask everyone who's not speaking to mute themselves until their presentations or questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal if necessary. Your Honors, this case is about one of the last remaining structural errors that requires reversal of a defendant's convictions without any consideration of harm, the deprivation of the right to counsel of choice. When a defendant requests an adjournment to hire private counsel, the trial court must conduct a reasoned, thoughtful analysis of that request. The failure to conduct this analysis in and of itself renders any denial of a continuance a violation of the defendant's rights. Thus, if a trial court fails to engage in the necessary reasoned and thoughtful analysis when denying a continuance, the trial court has committed a structural error that requires reversal of defendant's convictions. Just such an error occurred in Mr. Maisonette's case. He requested a continuance to hire private counsel. The trial court, without asking any questions, finding any facts, or weighing any of the Ferguson factors, summarily denied his request. The trial court failed to engage in any analysis, let alone the reasoned, thoughtful analysis required by this court in Cates. The trial court's failure to analyze, weigh, or even thoughtfully explain its decision-making means that the denial of a continuance here is entitled to no deference. Instead, this complete lack of analysis by the trial court is a structural error that requires reversal of Mr. Maisonette's convictions. And that concludes my opening statement.
Counsel, the trial court here no doubt should have reviewed the factors under our case law. If a reviewing court can nonetheless glean the relevant considerations from the record, is it appropriate for that to happen?
No. Essentially, there are, as laid out in Cates, there's essentially two ways for the denial of the continuance to be structural error. The first is if the trial court fails to conduct the required analysis by Cates, this reasoned, thoughtful analysis. And the second is if the court conducts the analysis but abuses its discretion in that analysis. And where we're talking about the first kind of error, as we are here, this absence of analysis cannot be salvaged on appeal, because as the appellate division held in Cates and later the appellate division in Martinez held, it's the trial court's job to do this analysis. It's not for appeals courts.
But tell us why. Accept the principle that you've articulated, that the trial court should be conducting this analysis. When the trial court fails to do so, why cannot it be done on the appellate level if the record permits it?
Because what's required in order to ensure a defendant's right to counsel of choice is respected is a reasoned, thoughtful analysis. That is what's required by the Sixth Amendment, that's required in order to ensure that a defendant is not arbitrarily and summarily deprived of the right to choose his own lawyer.
So if that reasoned, thoughtful analysis can be conducted, albeit at a later stage, how is the defendant harmed?
I would push back a little bit on that. Because if there is no analysis, the absence of analysis is the error. And because that is the error, and as the U.S. Supreme Court has made abundantly clear, that error is structural, there's no consideration at all of harm to the defendant.
Isn't there something in addition to absence of analysis? There is no record because the judge did not permit the defendant to speak. We don't know whether or not the defendant could have been able to hire another attorney within a week whether a short adjournment would have prejudiced the state or any other of the factors that would have occurred had there been a colloquy. It's not just analysis. There was no colloquy, and therefore there was the development of no record. Am I mistaken?
No, Your Honor. That is exactly right. What happened in Mr. Manzanet's case is the trial court failed to elicit any facts. And in fact, when Mr. Manzanet tried to explain himself, the court told him to stop talking. And the court simply said, you said that already. I'm denying your request. The court
So you're jumping to the facts, which I appreciate, and I do want to get to. But I first would like to understand your principled position here, and that is that even if one can glean from the record how the analysis of the factors should have been conducted at the trial court, even if there's enough there, not appropriate to consider on appeal. It's an automatic reversal.
Yes, Your Honor. And essentially, the reason for it is appeals courts are reviewing what the trial court did and why they did it. So if the trial court conducts a reasoned, thoughtful analysis, then an appellate court reviewing that decision has all the information needed to review whether that denial of the continuance amounts to an abuse of discretion. So if, for example, the trial court said, I've heard your request, I understand you want to hire a private attorney, but I have a tea time on Thursday and we absolutely cannot push this back because I want to go golfing, that would be an abuse of discretion. But the trial court can't avoid appellate review, essentially, by failing to conduct an analysis. Appellate courts need, sorry, Justice Lubecki, I can't hear you.
All right, now I'm not muted. Just a few pages earlier than the exchange that you and the court have been focused on the last few minutes, the court said, we're here for trial. We have a jury that's ready to come up. So the context in which this exchange is taking place provides, I think, an arguable basis right in the record to infer that the convenience to the court and to the jurors and to the state would be affected by this rather, well, not rather, in my view, totally open-ended request for a postponement in the hopes that resources or contributions by family members might come forward with the ability for him to hire counsel. We don't even have a specific request for the length of time the postponement was being requested. So on the face of this record, a number of the Ferguson factors seem to be answered, even without the more normal colloquy to pull some of this information out. It's right there, plain on the record, from when this is happening and how it is unfolding. Why can't we take notice or acknowledge that in assessing whether or not the court properly balanced the need to control its calendar with this late request to hire counsel of choice by someone who was indigent?
Because even if we have those facts, and I would submit we don't actually have all of the facts that we need, but even if the trial court had those facts must be balanced and weighed against one another. And we don't know if the jurors who are here for trial could be sent to another courtroom for more jury selection. We don't know how the jury selection was going to go. The court doesn't analyze at all how long the case has been pending and whether it's an abnormally long time or in line with other issues.
But we know from the record that this trial was a year after the indictment. The trial had been listed for quite a period of time. The defendant here had this particular public defender for a period of time and it waited till the day of trial for this request, but it could have been done sooner. That's just following up on Justice Lubecki saying. The court consider that also? And that doesn't need a whole, that's factual. It's not analysis. It's a year. He waited. He knew he had this defender signed and then he waited till the day of trial, not even the eve of trial, the day of trial, to make this request. Shouldn't that, can't that be considered?
No, because what is required by Cates is a reasoned, thoughtful analysis by the trial court, applying these facts to the situation at hand, to the relevant law. And if the trial court felt that it had all the facts, it would need to explain why the defendant's request should be denied by balancing that against the court's desire to control its calendar.
How specific, counsel, should the court be assured that an indigent person who's receiving legal services through the public defender has the ability to now hire counsel of choice? I mean, this pre-sentence report shows this defendant was over approximately $22,000 in arrears on child support. So he obviously, there was a clear basis for the public defender representation. And now comes this request that he wants to ask unknown family members if they will contribute funds so that potentially he can hire counsel so at some future date that counsel could substitute in. What kind of questions does a court have to, you know, what would the court even ask him? Who are you going to ask in your family? What kind of resources do they have? What is your relationship with those people? I'm not clear what kind of analysis is even appropriate to assess this claim.
It's not a mechanical test. The trial court doesn't need to say any magic words. But if the trial court is basing its decision on the defendant's lack of funds, it has to explain that. It has to make that clear, because that provides both a reason for the denial and something for an appellate court to review. And
so,
here,
so we know, for example, we know the answer to factor six. Does the defendant have other competent counsel prepared to try the case? And based on Justice LaVecchia explaining what he said to the court, far from a perfect analysis of the factors, we still can glean from the record the answer to that question. That yet your position is it's not appropriate for an appellate court to do that. If the trial court failed, automatic reversal. Am I correct?
Yes. The trial court, it is incumbent upon the trial court to find facts and analyze the Ferguson factors. And the failure to do that cannot be salvaged on appeal by speculating as to reasons that the continuance could legitimately have been denied.
The factors come from Burton, a D.C. Circuit case, correct? Are you familiar with what the D.C. Circuit does in circumstances such as this, where the trial court doesn't go through the factors with care, but the appellate court can do so? Are you familiar with how it's handled in the D.C. Circuit?
I have read Burton, but I apologize. I do not remember off the top of my head what the D.C. Circuit does.
Well, let me ask it this way. Can you cite any law to us that calls for automatic reversal when the trial court has failed to go through the factors with care, but the record nonetheless enables a reviewing court to do so?
In both Cates, the appellate division, and this court's opinion, and in Martinez from the appellate division in 2015, the appellate division held that it was not its job to imagine facts that conceivably would have justified the denial of a continuance. It is, quote, it is not for us to speculate. It was incumbent upon the trial court to develop that record and to apply those factors. And the failure to do that is the structural error that triggers reversal.
Even if the appellate court doesn't have to imagine but can go to the record, that's your position?
Yes, and it's partially because without the trial court explaining itself, there's no way to know whether the basis for the trial court's decision actually was an appropriate exercise of discretion in controlling its own calendar, or whether it was considering inappropriate.
Chuck Castle, I don't know why you need to go as far as you are going here. We have Ferguson factors. If all of the information that is in the Ferguson factors were elicited on the record, that would be one thing. But we don't have that. from what I can see, because the trial judge shut the defendant down from the very beginning and didn't permit any information. We do know that the request was on the eve of trial. It was the day of trial. That's one fact that we know. We don't know the length. If you look at all of the, I'm looking at the Ferguson factors. I don't see any other information that was elicited. The length of the adjournment he would have requested had he been permitted to speak, whether or not a family member had money to retain a private counsel, whether or not it would have been difficult to adjourn the case for a week. All of the information that is supposed to be elicited from the Ferguson factors, which this trial just did not do, did not follow the law, that's not on the record, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
What I don't understand in response to your questions to the chief, of all the information were there, that would be one thing for an appellate court to make a decision. I just don't see the information. Go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, I think what is clear is the extent of the trial court's colloquy, if you can even call it that, with Mr. Maisonette is clearly insufficient. The trial court does not ask any facts, doesn't even ask how long of a continuance are you asking for. It doesn't analyze the relative inconvenience to anyone. It doesn't discuss any of these factors. It doesn't discuss whether, for example, the prosecutor had previously requested any adjournments. There's just no adequate information about the majority of the Ferguson factors here, such that this colloquy cannot be found to be the reasoned, thoughtful analysis required by this court in Cates. And
Ms. McClain, can I ask a question? And it goes to, I mean, we're focused on Ferguson factors and counsel of choice. I think, or I'm going to ask you, do you agree that without resources, if we were just dealing with somebody who did not like his public defender and wanted to ask for a different public defender, we would not be engaging in this kind of analysis of the exchange in the request for a postponement, correct?
Correct. Right to counsel of choice.
Yeah. Right. So it's not same counsel of choice. So I'm asking you, and I'm coming back to a question I started with, what does the defendant get to do in terms of engaging in the trial court's let me rephrase that. What does the trial court have to do in order to maintain control over her calendar when somebody who's being represented by the public defender doesn't say, I want another public defender, but makes an allegation that suddenly he wants to switch to counsel of choice without an explanation for how he reasonably is going to get there? Does that mean every defendant who's represented by a public defender who now wants, on the eve of trial, a postponement to see if they can get counsel of choice, now wrests control of the court's calendar from the trial court?
Not at all. The trial court just has to elicit those facts. Ask a defendant, you are currently represented by the public defender. Do you have any money to hire a lawyer? If he presumably says no,
well,
then
didn't he answer that question? Didn't he answer that question by saying, I want to contact family members? I mean, by his request, he implicitly is saying he doesn't have the ability to do it, and he's relying upon the charitable help of unnamed people who he hasn't even asked yet.
But for all we know, he has a wealthy uncle who is best friends with a lawyer. We don't have those facts. And without those facts, without asking those questions, the trial court can't expect a defendant to volunteer the exact Ferguson factors without knowing the law. If the trial court wants to deny his request on that basis, it must elicit those facts and then deny it on that basis. It's not for an appellate court to guess as to what the trial court was thinking.
And counsel, isn't it true?
Go ahead.
Based on the facts that we have, did the judge give the defendant the ability to explain how he would get there give, you know, ask the questions with regard to whether there were one, two, or 10 family members he was going to call, or whether it was, you know, his one wealthy uncle, or, you know, just a limited number of people that he possibly could have obtained a fairly quick answer with regard to their ability to assist him get another attorney.
No, the trial court didn't ask any questions. And when the defendant tried to, Mr. Maisonet tried to explain his request further earlier in the colloquy, the trial court told him to stop talking. The trial court told him, your request is denied, you've said that already. Essentially, that's it, we're going to trial. And the trial court initially started with the right thing. Mr. Maisonet said, I don't want this attorney to represent me at trial. And so the trial court did the right thing and said, okay, you have two options. Or three options. You can have your public defender, you can hire a private attorney, or you can go pro se. And so then Mr. Maisonet made the reasonable follow-up request of, oh, okay, let's see if I can try to hire a private attorney by asking family members for help. And at that point, he was following what the trial court had told him to do, and instead of asking him follow-up questions as to how feasible that is or analyzing the other relevant Ferguson factors, the trial court simply said, no, your request is denied. You've said that already. And that's not applying and weighing the Ferguson factors. That's not reasoned analysis. And that, in and of itself, is a structural error. That is it's an abuse of discretion to fail to consider these factors when denying a request for
continuance. We have a brusque response from the court, and I agree with you on that. But it's to me significant to look at the setting here. We have a situation where
the court smart recording line. You are now on the record. You will hear periodic beeps as
confirmation
of the recording.
Recording or something. But you have a situation where the court is ready to. It is the day of trial. And you don't have a situation where the individual shows up and something has just occurred in his relationship with his lawyer, which is causing him to have no confidence in his lawyer. He's been represented by the lawyer for some time, and the issue is he says her level of experience, but nothing new has happened. Okay, so you have the court about to bring a jury up, and all of a sudden, a fact that has been known to the defendant, at least as far as we can tell from this record, for some time, which is that the lawyer had not previously tried a murder case, but had tried two criminal cases previously, is suddenly a reason to dismiss the lawyer. Can we take into consideration the timing and the nature of the request and what prompted the request in assessing what the court's response was? Not something that was raised in a previous conference, not something that just came up right before the day of trial that, you know, couldn't have been raised previously.
The trial court unquestionably can consider those factors. Those are part of the Ferguson factors. However, it is a fact-sensitive analysis. The trial court has to really grapple with the request and balance the defendant's right to go to trial with a private attorney if he chooses to do so versus the convenience to the court and the court's need to control its calendar. And without eliciting additional facts or using the facts that are present in this record to balance the Ferguson factors, there simply is not the required reasoned thoughtful analysis.
Should the defendant be required to provide some factual reasons besides the attorney has never tried a murder case before they can argue that she's not qualified?
So the defendant made the request for a continuance to hire private counsel.
You're not answering my question. My question is, the defendant just said she's never tried a murder case before. She can't do this right. Is that all that's necessary? Should it be more to it than that?
So the defendant in this, what we have here is the defendant said that, and then the trial court gave him options based on that request.
Yes. But is that statement alone sufficient to warrant to trigger the further factors that the he has no conscience because he has never tried a murder trial before?
That isn't sufficient, but when defendant specifically said, then I ask for a postponement to hire private counsel, that triggers the Ferguson analysis.
Do we know when the defendant learned of his attorney's, I'll put in quotation marks, inexperienced, that she had only tried two cases before, now she was undertaking a murder case? Do we know when he first learned about that?
We don't. As Your Honor has been pointing out, there's a vacuum.
And that's part of the lack of a factual record, because the judge refused to engage in any sort of colloquy with the defendant to elicit any facts.
Yeah. The trial court did not ask the defendant when he found that out, if he'd taken any steps to do this, if it is, as in Cates, a situation where he found out on the first day of jury selection that this was his attorney's first time doing a murder trial. We simply don't know, because the trial court didn't ask, and on top of that, prevented Mr. Maisonette from explaining his request further. The trial court cut off any discussion, and I'm not saying...
Actually, the defendant started out by explaining why he was asking for a continuance, and mm-hmm. It wasn't to get private counsel, was it?
The defendant began by asking, essentially, if he could have a different public defender. He said this attorney
hasn't... Well, and he explained why.
And the trial court then appropriately said, you don't get a new public defender. You can have...
Wait a minute. Let me stop there. Let me just ask you the questions. He explained why he felt he wasn't the right one to represent. And he talked briefly about she's never tried a murder trial. But the court did say she's an experienced trial attorney. The court did make that finding. But he went on to say, I don't feel I'm being represented right. When I got together with her in the beginning, that's a year ago when she started representing him. So for a year, I said if she could get me the right deal, I was okay with that. So he was there asking for a request because he wanted a better deal. And he went on to explain that. Isn't that why he was asking for a continuance? And isn't that in front of the trial judge? And isn't this even a weaker defendant's case than McLaughlin, which this court decided, where a defendant had a public defender, had a private counsel ready to go, and this court said, on the eve of trial, under these circumstances, you've had it for 2 years. In that case, it's not enough, and the trial court didn't abuse its discretion. Isn't this even a weaker position for the defendant than the defendant in McLaughlin?
If the trial court had undertaken the analysis and asked the defendant a few more questions and really analyzed his request against the court's calendar, then perhaps the trial court could have denied a continuance. But here, the trial court asked no questions, failed to address the Ferguson factors explicitly, and after the defendant, he first requested a new attorney. The court says, no, you can have your public defender, a private lawyer, or go pro se. And he said, okay, I want a continuance to hire a private lawyer. After that request, which is the thing that triggers the Ferguson analysis, the
Let
court
me stop
says,
you there. How is that any different, in fact, a weaker stance than it was for the defendant in McLaughlin, where he said, I want a continuance on the eve of trial. I have a private attorney, but I need a little time, a couple weeks, for him to get acquainted. And we said, no, you're not entitled to that under the circumstances. How is this a better situation than that was? This is, he wanted a continuance. It's all on the record. It's before the court. He wasn't happy with the deal. Then finally, after some back and forth, he says, well then, I want to talk to my family and see if they can get money together. We don't even know. There's no way for anybody to say what time that's going to take. On the eve of trial, with the jury in the box, not in the box, but the jury on call, It was the jury in the box. But how is that? It wasn't. Okay. It was jury panel been in, jury been impaneled. How is that any different? That's worse than the facts of McLaughlin. And we've already dealt with this.
Two responses. Factually, it was jury selection, not the actual first day of trial. And
now,
as to the...
Well, actually it is. Jury selection is the first day of trial.
Yes, but we don't have... We don't have 14 jurors sitting in a box ready to go.
I don't think
we
did McLaughlin either.
We don't know. The trial court didn't say, look, we're ready to go to trial. How long of the continuance are you asking for?
He told six months, that's unreasonable. He's got to decide how long it's going to... Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean
Justice Albin asked you if we have in the record how long he knew that... this alleged inexperience of his lawyer, and just looking at the colloquy that Justice Solomon flagged, I think we do know, because he says that when I got together with her in the beginning, I said if she could get me the right deal, I was okay with that, and immediately preceding it is a discussion about the lack of experience. So the beginning sounds like when she was assigned. May have been as long as a year or even more before. So don't we have in the record that he had known about this alleged deficiency in his lawyer, although he expressed this great respect for his lawyer and, you know, was very generous in his praise of her, but this concern he has about her lack of experience was known to him for a very long time before this moment, this epiphany that he had on the day of jury selection.
The trial court, after the defendant asked for an adjournment, it's the entire going from his request to the denial is 21 lines. This court in Cates said a trial court doesn't have to engage in a lengthy factual colloquy, but must conduct a reasoned, thoughtful analysis. And if this is a reasoned, thoughtful analysis by a trial court without citing Ferguson, without expressly addressing the Ferguson factors, without weighing the factors against each other, without asking Mr. Mason at any questions at all, without discussing the court's calendar, relative scheduling, prior continuances, anything. If this is a reasoned, thoughtful analysis, then absolutely anything other than a trial court simply saying no is going to be a reasoned, thoughtful analysis. Holding that this is a good enough analysis guts Cates. It fundamentally changes the nature of what is required when a trial court denies a continuance for when a defendant wants to hire a private attorney.
Other questions? Please finish your thought, Ms. McClain.
No, that's all. I would just emphasize that in Cates, this court stated what is required, which is a reasoned, thoughtful analysis. And these 21 lines aren't it. And for that reason, it's not for appellate courts to speculate. And instead, it's incumbent upon the trial court to do the requisite analysis. And the absence of that analysis here requires reversal of Mr. Maisonette's convictions.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to start by focusing the conversation on the constitutional right at stake here, which is the right to choice of counsel. Both this court and the United States Supreme Court have recognized that the choice of counsel is a fundamental right that is so integral to the judicial process that it requires additional protections. These additional protections come in the form of structural error review, which basically removes deference to trial court decisions that have the potential to implicate structural error. Now, this court last addressed structural error as it relates to adjournment request for choice of counsel back in 2014 in State v. Cates. Now, in deciding State v. Cates, this court created a clear and concise roadmap that explains exactly how to handle adjournment requests for choice of counsel. Unfortunately, in this case, neither the trial court nor the appellate division followed that roadmap. When faced with an adjournment request for choice of counsel, the trial court must conduct a reasoned and thoughtful analysis and consider the factors enumerated in State v. Ferguson. Now, this is where the trial court... We believe that the transcript accurately reflects the fact that the trial court did not conduct the type of reasoned and thoughtful analysis required by this court in Cates. In fact, it would take longer to read the Ferguson factors that the court was supposed to consider than it would to read the relevant portion of the transcript where the state claims that such an analysis occurred.
Mr. Johnson,
do you really believe that? Yes, sir.
Do you share Ms. McLean's view that that's essentially the end of the analysis? That if the trial court judge doesn't conduct the appropriate analysis, defendant gets a new trial. You don't later attempt to glean from the record, to infer from the record, from the full context, how this might well have come out, should have come out based on objective information. End of story, automatic reversal. Is that your position as well?
Yes, Chief Justice. And some folks might think that that's an extraordinary position to take. But it is only somewhat extraordinary because of the structural error framework that this right exists in. This isn't the state of the law in most cases. It would be appropriate for some type of harmless error review, but not when we're talking about a constitutional right that implicates structural error.
Not talking about harmless error in the traditional sense. Talking about whether a court at this stage can review the factors and make a reasoned determination based on what exists. Your position is, don't go there. It's verboten. Is there any law in the country you can cite to that supports that position?
So I think the best citation for that is State v. Cates, which this court decided, and that structural error protection, which Cates kind of brought into our jurisprudence. Comes from the United States versus Gonzalez-Lopez, I do believe, and that creates the structural error framework where it's inappropriate to go back and run the analysis for the trial court, and that's essentially what both the appellate division in this case and the state are attempting to do, and we do believe that that's entirely inappropriate under Cates.
Well, my question is why, if it can be done, why is it inappropriate to do so?
Because it's a structural error, Chief Justice. The issue becomes, even if it is possible to go back years down the line and review the record, as we are attempting to do right here, if we go back and review the record, it is basically a slap in the face to structural error. It needs to be done at the trial court level because of the structural error framework that it exists in, Your Honor. And I think that framework does it.
Mr. Johnson, following up on a question by the chief, is there a sufficient record on which an appellate court or any court could determine whether or not an adjournment should have been granted based on Cates? Is there a sufficient record?
In this case, Your Honor, I do not believe that there is a sufficient record. But I'm also willing to go one step further the same way that defense counsel was. We believe that even if there was all of the information that you needed, the analysis was not run. So it's not enough for us to be able to go back and find information in the record.
Assuming all of the Ferguson questions were asked, and everything, so we would have known the length of the adjournment request, the likelihood of obtaining counsel, whether or not they would have been prejudiced to the state, and all the other information. If all that was laid out on the record, are you suggesting that an appellate court couldn't, under those circumstances, make a decision whether or not an adjournment request should have been granted or denied?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. It's not appropriate for the appellate division to go back and make that decision. The appellate division has to decide whether or not the trial court conducted the analysis, and once they decide that it didn't happen, a new trial is required. They cannot conduct that analysis themselves. Okay.
Mr. Johnson, do you think the trial court, having presided over the matter, having interacted with the parties, is in the best position to conduct that analysis and ask those questions and obtain those facts?
Absolutely, especially since the review can be lengthy. We're now 3 years down the line. The trial court is basically the only court that is in the proper position to run that analysis and ask those questions. But as you said, they need to ask those questions. They need to elicit the proper information, and that comes directly from Kate as well.
Is there anything you'd like to add to your presentation?
Yes, so I'll finish with this. Based on a plain reading of Kate, any defendant who makes an adjournment request for choice of counsel has the right to a reasoned and thoughtful analysis. Now, the appellate division must review that decision for structural error, which means if the trial court did not conduct a reasoned and thoughtful analysis, the appellate division finds structural error and orders a new trial. That is the end of the analysis. And in this case, we believe that the trial court clearly did not conduct a reasoned and thoughtful analysis, and also that the appellate division erred by reviewing it for under a harmless error standard instead of reviewing for structural error as required by Cates. So we just request that this court take the opportunity to clarify that Cates is still controlling on these issues. It is the control precedent. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Campolone. You're muted. Please unmute.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justices, and may it please the court. The appellate division properly affirmed the defendant's conviction for murder and found the trial court did not commit a mistaken exercise of its discretion in denying the defendant's belated adjournment request because the trial record demonstrates the court did consider the factors under Ferguson. Based on this, the trial court heard directly from the defendant the reason for the delay was solely based on the fact that his public defender had not tried a homicide case before. Also, the defendant acknowledged that not only did he not have another defense attorney available, he did not know even if he could afford a private defense attorney. Taking the defendant's words into consideration, coupled with the fact that this request came as the court was about to select a jury, addresses several of the factors set forth within Ferguson. As determined by this court in State v. Cates, the inquiry by the trial court is fact-specific to the case at hand, but this does not mean the court must go through a factual lengthy inquiry. The state would suggest, based on Cates, that when considering the factors, the trial court should engage in a qualitative analysis, not a quantitative analysis, which is what occurred here. Because there is evidence on the record that the trial court considered the relevant factors and did not summarily deny the defendant's request, no structural error occurred. Therefore, the case should not be remanded for a new trial. Additionally, because the judge properly considered the factors, deference should be given to the trial court without a need to determine if prejudice occurred. However, should this court find that the consideration of factors was not sufficient, the defendant here was not prejudiced by the denial based upon the overwhelming evidence of guilt presented at trial. This concludes my opening statement, Your Honors.
Do you believe that the trial court followed the dictates of Cates, that trial courts should consider various factors outlined in Ferguson?
I do believe the trial court did follow Cates in that respect. I believe taking into account the specific nature of the request, along with the time it took for this request to come in, meaning he had been with this attorney for 15 months. He admitted he liked this attorney, but he didn't like the fact that she could not get him a good plea. Based on that, you have a jury about to be selected. Based upon he didn't have a defense attorney that he had spoken to. No name was dropped.
Counsel, do you have the Ferguson factors in front of you?
I do, Your Honor.
I'll make it easy. Instead of my going through, tell me which of the Ferguson factors the judge complied with. Tell me what, look down at the factors and tell me which ones he complied with in this colloquy.
Okay, so for the first factor, I think, do you want me to go one through seven, or can I jump around a little bit?
Well, start with the number one, because the first one is the length of the requested delay. Did he ask that?
The judge here did not ask the defendant directly how long the length of the request would be.
Okay, so we know that. So we know he didn't comply with that one. Look at number two, whether other continuances have been requested and granted. Did he do that one?
The state would argue that the trial court, with this factor, confirmed with the defendant that he knew who his attorney was and he knew the trial date for a substantial period of time.
No, counsel, go look at, I'm not going to take you through, look at the factors. Go factor by factor and tell me whether or not the judge elicited any facts according to the factors. Look at the factors.
The judge did not ask any specific question regarding if other requests had been made in regards to this postponement.
And did he comply with any of the other factors? Look at any of them.
Well, the state would suggest that the factors were addressed within the request by the defendant. Therefore, there was no need for the judge to specifically go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 through the factors.
Let me ask you this question, and I don't want to belabor this. Sometimes I try to understand why we write our opinions if the judges are not going to follow them. We wrote Cates. We said there are these Ferguson factors. We directed our trial judges to ask these questions, and then they're not asked. Are we involved as a court in a pointless exercise in writing these opinions?
I do not believe so, Your Honor, and I don't think the trial court here did not follow Cates. I believe that, once again, if you take the facts of the case, this judge has been with the case for this time, the defendant's words, I think you can address the Ferguson factors within that.
One of the issues that I just would flag on this is that the court, you know, obviously judges have the right not to be interrupted, just as lawyers have the right not to be interrupted. And it seems that the don't keep talking or whatever his stop, don't dash, stop talking line was a response to an interruption by the defendant. However, there is no point in this colloquy where the judge essentially tells the defendant, now you can talk, I'm done. Would you agree that this was not best practices in terms of how to have a colloquy with a defendant?
It is accurate the judge never went back to let the defendant address his concerns, but he did get them out. This isn't the Cates case where the only word spoken by the defendant was, yes, Your Honor. There's a great deal of conversation from the defendant in regards to why he's making this request, and there was enough given by him that the court had enough to make the decision that this was clearly a delay tactic by the defendant. Therefore, we weren't going to go down this rabbit hole of now, 15 months later, we're going to postpone for a new attorney.
Ms. Campolone, even the very best judges can make mistakes and can be unaware of case law. If a judge doesn't go through the Ferguson factors laid out in our case law, does that require automatic reversal?
I do not believe so, Chief Justice. I believe, as this court was discussing, if an appellate division can glean from the record enough information to satisfy the factors and make the decision that it was not an unfair denial, then I do believe the appellate division has the ability to do that.
Please go on with your argument. Is there anything else you'd like to present?
I would just say that I think it's unfair to state that in the record below that the trial court shut down the defendant without any explanation. Like I said, in Cates, that was a straight denial of that defendant being able to explain why he did not want to proceed with an attorney who he had never met before. Whereas this record, the defendant was able to get enough information out within the request. And I don't think that places the burden on defendants to know the factors when they're making their request. I just think in this case, and we need to look at specific cases when we make these decisions, there was enough information in the record by the defendant himself to justify the denial. Unless Your Honors have any other questions.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. McLean, rebuttal. Please unmute.
Unmute.
Sorry about that. I would just briefly like to draw this court's attention to the cases cited in the appellate division opinion in Cates, particularly the ones from the Third Circuit, where the appellate division essentially got the principle that the failure to do an analysis is itself arbitrary. If a court doesn't do an analysis, its decision is definitionally, it's any denial is arbitrary because it's not based on reasons. And so, for example, in it's when in the Third Circuit, it talks about the district court failing to deal with the, essentially failing to find facts and deal with the defendant's request, and without, you know, explaining its reasons. And that's what the court did here. There may have been reasons to deny this request, but from what the trial court did, without asking questions, without going through the Ferguson factors, without even recognizing that the defendant's constitutional right to choose his own to counsel of choice was at stake, the trial court just said no. And that denial is arbitrary, and because it is arbitrary, it is structural error that requires reversal of Mr. Maisonette's convictions.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to all counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement.